You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of March 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's programme.
The strike was being done yesterday night was effective. We hope that we reach all the objectives soon and we deny them to continue to harm the population of Yemen.
A spokesman for Saudi Arabia's coalition on another day of airstrikes against Houthi rebels in Yemen. I'll be joined by Jane Kinnamont and Alessio Patilano to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including Nigeria's presidential election in which the rival candidates have felt it necessary to make explicit what should be implicit, that they'll respect the result. Turkey's new anti-protest laws, which have so far done little but encourage more of what they're supposed to prevent, and a possibly optimistic attempt by Japan's Prime Minister to persuade his country's citizens to spend less time at the office. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the programme. My guests today are Jane Kinnamont, Deputy Head of the Middle East and North Africa programme at Chatham House, and Alessio Patilano, Lecturer in War Studies at King's College London. Welcome back to Midori House, both of you. We will begin today's show in Yemen. It's all pretty straightforward. Shia rebels, probably backed by Iran, are fighting forces commanded by an exiled president, except for those of Yemen's army who are supporting the Houthis and others who are loyal to another president entirely, and all of them are at war with al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Some of them are probably at war with Islamic State. Saudi Arabia has now started bombing the Houthis in cahoots with nine other Arab countries, more or less supported by the United States. Jane, this should all be sorted out by about lunchtime tomorrow, shouldn't it?
Well, Yemen is an extraordinarily complex place, so we could throw into the mix that you've described also.
I was just outlining the basics there.
The southern separatist movement, increasingly likely to feel that they're not that keen to remain a
Those
part
guys.
Of Yemen. Various divisions within the coalition that are attacking, the wider tensions between Saudi Arabia and Iran. But this is something very unusual, and maybe it is a glimpse into the future in that this operation is really being led by local armies. Mm-hmm. And many people in the Middle East aspire to a region that can sort out its own security problems without Western intervention. The problem is that they may be repeating some of the negative tendencies of Western intervention, notably an over-reliance on airstrikes, with little idea of what the political picture is going to look like the day after.
I mean, I think there's a great many people outside the Middle East who yearn for a Middle East that can sort its own problems out as well. Alessio, there is, as Jane has just elaborated, so very, very much to talk about here.
Yes.
One obvious compare and contrast thing which has occurred to me at least, why have the Middle Eastern powers who've managed to get together very, very quickly in this instance been rather less keen to get together and do anything as decisive about Islamic State? Is it a straightforward Sunni versus Shia question?
Well, I suppose that is a part of that. I think it was much easier to get a coalition in this context because it was a much clearly defined type of threat, something that would be sort of very much localized in Yemen. It has also a clear sense of contrast between the Yemeni official authorities and the other side. So in a way, it was a lot easier to get the necessary coalition of the willing, as it were, all together. And I think what is important, the point that Jane was making, I think this might be the beginning or something extremely interesting, the consequences of which, both in positive and negative terms, might last for with us for quite some time. And in the positive sense, I think really there is a tremendous amount of expectation as to an understanding of this coalition that is firmly placed in the Middle East and has a military dimension, that this is the first time, and it's the first time that is deploying not just sort of in any sort of in support of someone else. They are organizing it. It is based on the deployment of high-tech type of combat capabilities, which requires a degree of command and control and organizational structure. So from the point of view of provided sort of the broader problems that we have in the Middle East, it is very important to see how this goes, because it might be the beginning of a sense of responsibility within the Middle East of stronger countries that are trying to sort of set the agenda in terms of how to take care of the security in the region in their own terms. And the fact that they're doing here make it kind of easier in a way to test this out.
Jane, from the perspective of Riyadh, which have taken very much the lead in putting this coalition together, the question that, well, actually I'm not persuaded that enough governments do ask themselves this question before they intervene somewhere, but a question one would think you should ask yourself before you intervene is, looking at Yemen from Riyadh's point of view, what happens if they do nothing? Why is this potentially a threat to Saudi Arabia?
They were alarmed to see the extent of the Houthis' escalation, particularly to see the Houthis going into Aden, where the internationally recognised president was holed up and basically forcing him to flee the country. They were worried about the potential for civil strife in Yemen, which of course hasn't gone away as a result of the airstrikes. But more broadly, it's about Saudi fear of Iran at a time when they think that the US is about to potentially make a historic agreement with Iran. They are worried that Iran could see a nuclear deal as a green light to step up its influence in the region. They see Yemen as one sign of this. Ultimately, they would be afraid that Iran could even try to foment unrest among the Shia population in Saudi Arabia itself. Yemen is therefore almost an issue of national security to them.
Is that a reasonable point from Riyadh's point of view? I mean, I'm not the first to make this observation either, Alessio, but the Saudis looking at Tehran and then looking at the region around them, and they see Damascus, Baghdad, Beirut, and now Sana'a all at least partially controlled from Tehran, or at least Tehran having a very, very strong influence in all four.
It's a very good point. And I think what Jane was saying is actually very important, in the sense that we're at a stage whereby Saudi Arabia has to make a statement about where they stand in the region in face of a potential sort of rising Iran. And so Yemen, in that sense, provides the perfect opportunity. Again, if we look at how they are organizing the campaign, it's very disciplined, it's very sort of military-centric, very under control. It really is to strike a point, look at us. We're different. This is a different story. This is not Iran. This is not any country. We have both the political willingness to intervene as well as the military capabilities to send ourselves sort of apart from the rest. Look at us, join us if you want. And I think it is important, because no matter how hard the truth is that I'm not necessarily sure that situation in places like Iraq are particularly sort of under control. Yemen, again, has got a number of internal, even though localized, the problems. So the situation is not looking very good. Someone that steps up and sees itself, the repercussions of what is happening in neighboring areas as potentially affecting the country itself, like Saudi Arabia, has all the reasons to actually present itself in that way and show that sense of political strength.
Jane, you mentioned earlier as underrated or overlooked participants in this fracas today, and it really does. The more you look at it, the more it resembles the closing scene of Blazing Saddles, but everybody's armed. The southern separatists, are we likely to reach a point in which Yemen is sundered again? It hasn't been a unified country very long, only since 1990. Is its natural state actually North and South Yemen?
It's something that definitely could happen. Before this recent slide into violence, Yemen was having a peaceful national dialogue about its political future post the Arab Spring. And one of the things that people from all across Yemen decided on was that the country needed to be at least decentralised. It needed to become federal. If something like that doesn't happen in the future, you're probably going to see the South want to secede by force of arms. But other regions could as well, especially if the state has very little to knit it together, if it doesn't have a charismatic leader and it has very little resource wealth left.
And just a final thought on this one. I rather suspect that in days and weeks to come, we will have ample further opportunity to discuss Yemen. You mentioned this earlier, Alessio, that so far, at least, this is an airstrikes-only campaign. And obviously, this is something we have seen variations of going back, I guess you could say, to Bosnia now, where you have 21st century air forces waging war from the air against lightly armed, irregular military on the ground. Does it work?
Oh, you're asking this question to the wrong person, because I'm a naval man, so I would tell you that definitely it is not the answer. Strategic bombing has been, or precision bombing, or air campaign, or whichever version of it you want to adopt, never really found a solution to anything, really. Going back to World War II, when the Germans started, when they thought that bombing London would break the morale of the British. So in whichever format you look at it, it does create a lot of damage. It blows up a lot of things, but it doesn't really solve problems. And I think it could be effective in reducing the current sort of potential military threats on the ground, but it's not going to find a political or social solution. And going back to the reference you made to Bosnia, that was not solved by the bombs that we dropped. And I am pretty certain, even though historians always get these kind of things wrong, I'm pretty sure that I will be proven right, that this time as well, bombs dropped from a certain altitude will not change the real political and economic sort of problems and religious problems that are behind this.
Okay, well, it's not often that you get to say in a job like this, and now moving along to the relatively uncomplicated dateline of Nigeria, but it is one of those days. Africa's most populous country votes tomorrow in a presidential election, choosing between the incumbent Goodluck Jonathan, not widely hailed as a model of coherent, decisive leadership, and Muhammadu Buhari, the proverbial former military dictator unafraid to crack eggs in pursuit of omelettes. The two men have signed a pledge to respect the result and have urged their followers to refrain from violence. Alessia, why is this pledge necessary? It doesn't really seem like a hallmark of a established, relaxed democracy that the two men contesting its presidency would have to say, yeah, we'll totally respect the result of the election. We generally assume that.
No, we generally assume that, but I don't think, well, first of all, let's take a step back, because it is definitely there is a lot of momentum that has been created around this presidential election. Looking at newspapers, there is a massive number of people that are going back to Nigeria.
Been delayed once as well, of course, due to fighting with Boko Haram.
Exactly. So for the first thing to say is that this is definitely an important event and is definitely perceived as such by those who are there and the people of Nigeria. So in light of that, there is also a tremendous amount of pressure on the results. And of course, Nigerian politics, we all know, they have not been distinguished over the past few years, but what one would define the most liberal democratic of all processes. Certainly there are, overuses of police activities and sort of violence is not one of those currencies that has been entirely ruled out. So it seems to me that making the point, whatever the result is going to be, we will sort of respect it. And by the way, any sort of disagreement, please do not express it with violence. It seems to me it's an important message. There seems to be a message that is, this is the day of change. This is the change that we're all been waiting and many people are being waiting for, and we will respect it no matter what. I think also it is an important statement in light of the fact that with Boko Haram and the fact that the government has been seen as not particularly effective at dealing with it, this idea of a political process of rejuvenation will give something to the country in terms of the current unrest vis-a-vis the political inability to solve problems that have emerged of late.
There was, of course, dreadful violence after the last election in 2011, in which hundreds of people were killed. The thing that strikes me is, it does appear certainly from afar a somewhat depressing choice between these two gentlemen. But what does it tell us that I think Nigeria, I'm right in saying, is 15 or 16 years from having shaken off military dictatorship. And it's entirely possible that tomorrow the people of Nigeria could re-elect one of the military dictators. Is it just a craving for stability?
Mm. Well, it's some years since Buhari was in power before. He says he's changed.
But he
is not standing on a platform where he says, I ran the country for many years and I promised to bring back the old ways. He is positioning himself as an anti-corruption candidate, and that is where he does seem to have something of a record, that he was seen as being a disciplinarian, but one that wasn't that corrupt, and that is something that a lot of Nigerians do crave, especially those that aren't benefiting from the current corruption.
Is that, I mean, Alessio, and again, it's a sort of a general question that could be asked not so much about not just Nigeria, but far too much of Africa, especially West Africa, which is an incredibly resource-rich region of the world. And and Nigeria, for all its vast population, could indeed should be a much wealthier and more secure country.
Absolutely.
Are its structural problems, that corruption that Jane mentioned, and its bureaucracy and poor government, are they... Is it possible for one man to fix all that in the space of one presidential term?
Well, he definitely has the experience. He knows the place. He's been there. He's been running it. And in a way, the way he used to run it was partly justified by the fact that there was a lot of dysfunctionality. If there's one thing that dictatorships do bring about is the ability to have a very vertical hierarchical structure by which even one or a small number of people can take decisions and then implement them if they want to in a relatively short period of time. So it seems to me that he, both candidates have an idea of where the problems are, whether they're going to be able to implement them. I think there is a lot of crave for change in Nigeria, and that in itself is a very positive sign. Then again, the situation of Boko Haram and sort of instability over the borders, it might be an important issue that in the short term at least might prevent political action to kick into gear quickly.
There are things one man can do, even if corruption trickles down at all levels. Making examples of a few people at the top is very important. However, what usually happens is that somebody who comes into office punishes their political rivals for corruption and leaves their own cronies unpunished. So that would be one of the real tests if a new president found that one of his own ministers or his own friends or even relatives was guilty of corruption. Can he make an example of them?
But that leads us to, I guess, what you could call one of Nigeria's other structural problems. And I don't know where you would start with this, but it's very possible that to a large extent the vote tomorrow could be the Christian South voting against the Muslim North, for each for their preferred candidate.
Absolutely, and that's one of the reasons that the fears of violence are so high.
Yes.
Okay, well, we will take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, along with Jane Kinnamont and Alessio Patilano. When we come back, Turkey's leader thinks its people should protest less, and Japan's thinks its people should work less.
Our first Monocle Quality of Life Conference is taking place in Lisbon, Portugal, from Friday the 17th to Sunday the 19th of April. Over 3 days and with the help of 20 speakers, we're going to reveal the best projects, people and practices helping to create dynamic cities around the globe. Guest speakers include the legendary typographer Eric Spiekerman, celebrated architect Bjarke Ingels, and the V&A's director Martin Roth. This is an intimate weekend, and we know that important conversations will continue long after the speakers have left the stage. So we'll make sure there's plenty of opportunities to talk at the receptions, at the final night's dinner, and beyond. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference in Lisbon, Portugal, from the 17th to the 19th of April. Find out more at conference.monocle.com.
From the streets of Kabul to a girls' school in the shadow of the Hindu Kush, London-based artist George Butler spent 3 weeks in Afghanistan, reporting on life in the war-torn country through that most old-fashioned of methods, paper and ink.
This is in Herat, and as always, I just picked a spot that I thought I could describe what I was witnessing as best as I could. It's very much that balance in Afghanistan of how long it's safe to be there, but also that drive to try and describe to people what it's like in a place that is almost always described as dangerous or unsafe.
Art of War, a Monocle film, now playing on monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Jane Kinnamont and Alessio Patilano. Earlier today, Turkey's parliament passed a new homeland security bill, debate over which had been protracted, passionate, and hugely entertaining for we aficionados of the sort of parliamentary punch-ups traditionally a regional specialty of Taiwan and Ukraine. The bill which passed isn't quite the foundation of a police state that President Recep Tayyip Erdogan fondly envisaged, but it is not encouraging to people who disagree with him. Alessio, is this what it looks like, which is a sort of his long-awaited revenge for the Gezi Park protests in 2013?
It does look absolutely like that. And I think that's... now, it's interesting because some of the wording at the moment is very tricky because it's about discouraging, really, the interruption of quiet, the normal business, the everyday thing. So protesting is seen, is described as an evil thing that one has to control and reduce to nil. Then what about, you know, people's rights or, you know, in fact, even the in this respect, the wording is very interesting because it in principle, it authorizes police forces to use violence against protesters in that respect. So it shifts the balance of the content away from a manifestation of individuals having some sort of discontent with whatever it is that you are discussing, placing a lot more the emphasis on the right of state to bring the balance back and everything back in the natural order of things in this sense. So it's a very interesting thing because in one go, you're not only cracking down on protesters, but you are actually sort of making it look as if you're doing in the best interest of everybody else. So it's a very interesting way to take sort of almost basic human rights away from you and liberties in that sense.
Jane, it is now seeming like a dishearteningly long time since Turkey wanted to be thought of as this secular democratic bridge between Europe and the Middle East. Where is Erdogan going with this? Is it possible to tell what sort of country he wants Turkey to be?
Well, it's pretty ironic given his enthusiasm for supporting the popular protests across the rest of the Middle East in 2011.
That's true.
I think there's probably a short-term prize that he has his eyes on. He wants success in the next election. He wants the AK Party to get a two-thirds majority in Parliament so that he could change the constitution and strengthen the powers of the presidency, i.e. himself. So he will be concerned that there will be disruption and protests around the election. He has increasingly in recent years had a tendency to blame nefarious foreign forces for all kinds of
That's never a good sign when the leader starts blaming the foreign conspiracy.
And indeed seeking to ban social media, which is another classic sign that you are not a liberal democrat.
And indeed developing an exceedingly thin skin. Earlier this week, 37 students and teachers appeared in court on charges of insulting him, and they were far from the first. How reasonable is it, or how reasonably worried should we be about where Turkey is going? Because none of these signs are good. The thing Jane mentioned there, the fact that, you know, his occasional sort of lapses into some quite iffy, you know, conspiracy meanderings.
I think there is another angle that we should consider in this story, one in which Turkey has a very porous border, and it is becoming a place of destination for vast quantities of migrants. They're coming from Syria and other parts. You know, Turkey is now one of the major embarkation point for migrants that are trying to make the cross through the Mediterranean into the EU. And it's not just because the Turkish authorities are allowing them to do.
It has also a transit route for people travelling in the other direction as well, of course.
Yes, although I would say at the moment, provided I was looking at the data from Mare Nostrum last year, 157,000 people as opposed to 13,000 in 2013. That's a 12-to-1 increase in a year. So and a very good deal of them were coming from Turkey. So I think Turkey is at the centre also of a very different type of problem altogether, and this is a very important problem. That is, a lot of internal domestic and social unrest that is being produced because, simply put, people are seeing these porous borders, having lots of people coming in, and nobody really taking a serious position on what to do with them. So I think that the reaction, in part, is on one hand to keep a handle on Turkish domestic unrest. On the other, is also to empower authorities and sort of police forces as well to the ability at least to tackle the surface manifestations, if you want, a disagreement that might be generated by an otherwise complex internal situation where the fabric of the Turkish nation has been at the moment sort of diluted because there's so many other people entering into it. I mean, it's calculated there's about 1.5 million refugees from Syria into, you know, into Turkish territory. That's quite a lot. We're talking about a city that is like, well, a little bit smaller than Liverpool, I think. Yeah. So, you know, this is the kind of thing that we should put in perspective when we think about, yes, the Turkish authorities are getting much more rigid about this, sure, and it's not happy news for democracy and everything else. On the other hand, how would you feel if you had the population of the size of Liverpool getting into the UK within a matter of a year? That wouldn't make you feel sort of, you know, happy about it. UKIP would have a feast over it.
Well, UKIP, well, I mean, you could argue that it has happened and UKIP are, but those are, of course, legal immigrants. A final thought on this, Jane, and it's a bleak one about Turkey, but despite all of this, Erdogan is, you know, as you were noting, kind of popular. There's parliamentary elections on June the 7th, at which he does entertain hopes of a two-thirds majority. Is it possible that up until Erdogan, the idea of Turkey, the Ataturkist idea of Turkey as a secular democratic nation, was kind of wishful thinking?
Well, it's still consolidating its democracy. One of the reasons that Erdogan has certain paranoias is that he still has thought that people in the army and the security services were out to get him, were out to overturn democracy and so forth. There's a problem that he thinks that he represents real Turkish democracy, while the opposition think that they represent real Turkish democracy because they are more focused on the secularism, which Erdogan nominally respects but has arguably been eroding.
Okay, well, finally tonight, we'll look at Japan. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has suggested that the country's legendarily industrious workers knock off an hour or two early during the summer months to spend more quality time at home. But before any of our Japanese listeners hurl their hats too far in the air, Mr. Abe also just suggested that they get to work an hour or two earlier. He does say, in fairness to Shinzo Abe, and it's a remarkable thing for a Prime Minister of Japan to say, I'll ask you first, Alessio, he says Japan's culture falsely beatifies long hours. Is he right?
I think he's. I mean, because here we're moving all away from the model of just simply spending hours and hours in an office, and we're focusing more on work is assessed against productivity, against effectiveness. Now, you can be very effective if you work for hours and then you take the rest of the day free. So whatever makes you sort of more effective is the key to the solution. In Japan, this was never really the idea. The classic image, which, by the way, I'm very familiar with, especially civil servants having small little foldable beds in their offices, because it looks good with your boss if you spend the entire night or you stay there up until sort of midnight, and then at 6 a.m. you wake up from the little foldable.
They are considering passing laws to make people take their holidays.
Yes, but again, because there is this kind of, I would say, almost a social contract, social expectation that when you are in a company, you know, you are expected to be there for your boss at any given point in time. And I think that over time is being one major issue in terms of, you know, productivity and effectiveness at work. Another point that is important to underline here is, though, while he's saying this, he's also putting his finger on something very important. The Japanese, the 3 hours, Abenomics, in order to work, the Japanese have to spend more. If these people are always in their office, they're not doing much, and then they are tired and they go home.
And they're not having families either.
Not having families. So there's all sorts of a social change that is not just geared towards making work a more pleasant experience and a more effective experience, but also rethinking the Japanese society as a consumer society and as a society as a whole, you know, making babies, bringing families and other bits and pieces like that.
Like I said, it was a surprising thing for a Japanese prime minister to say, because of course that work ethic of Japan's is part of the reason they were able to take a ruin and turn it into a 20th century industrial superpower in a matter of decades. Jane, final thought, I guess, is it possible for a people to work too hard?
I think many of us think it is. Contrast the experience of the French, who would think this kind of work hours was absolutely crazy, and countries that have, such as Bhutan, which thought that it was a good idea to promote the measurement of gross national happiness instead of gross national product, because they don't produce very much at all.
Indeed, but you don't see many people driving Bhutanese cars or listening to Bhutanese radios. Jane Kinnunmont and Alessio Patalano, thank you both very much for joining us here at Midori House. That is all we have time for on today's show. It was produced by Tom Hall and Marcus Sippi, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Mikey Wynn, and our studio manager was Chad Childers. For the next half hour, Gillian de Bias is here with Monocle's International Playlist. At 1900 hours, the menu with Marcus Hippie. At 2200, The Daily with Emma Nelson and Peter Cardwell. Midori House returns on Monday at the same time, 1800 here in London, 1400 in New York. I'm Andrew... Actually, that's not right, is it? Yes, it is. Still, I think next week. Or is it? No, it's not next week. I think it's 5 hours again. It'd be 1300 in New York. Write that down. I'm Andrew Miller. Thank you very much for listening. Have a good weekend.